So the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes sets himself no mean task. In chapter 1, verse 13, he says, "And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven." In other words, as he examines life in this world and tries to make sense of it all, he's asking questions such as, is there purpose and meaning in life? Is all the effort that people expend on their various activities worthwhile? Or is it all pointless, a waste of time and energy? At the end of our brief lives in this world, have we actually achieved anything of lasting value? And as he goes about his task, the writer adopts two distinct viewpoints. And the key to understanding this book of Ecclesiastes is to know which view he is taking at any particular point. In some passages, he looks at things from a purely earthbound viewpoint. In many cases, those passages are marked out by his use of the phrase, "under the sun." And there he views everything only in terms of what he experiences in this world. There's no reference to God or to what may lie beyond this life. But then in other passages, he takes the opposite perspective. He brings God into the picture. He entertains the possibility that there is more to life than what we can discern with our senses. That it's not just a case of 70 years and then that's it. You're finished, you cease to exist. There is an eternal dimension to life. Human existence is not confined to time and space. And it's not surprising that from this second perspective, he reaches a very different conclusion about the meaning of life from when he adopted the first perspective. So today, I want us to consider chapter 3, verses 16 to 22, which is one of the under the sun passages. Here the writer largely considers matters from an earthbound perspective. I say largely because he doesn't leave God out of the reckoning altogether, and we'll see that surely. But overall, in these verses, the writer considers matters in terms of unaided human reason and what he can discover without reference to God. And that's certainly true of his conclusion, which he reaches in verse 22. So I'd like us then to think about these verses under three headings this morning. Our first heading is a perplexing observation. A perplexing observation. In his search for meaning to life, the writer of Ecclesiastes decides to pay a visit to the law courts. He describes them as the place of justice in verse 16. And I think we can understand his choice of destination. Surely the existence of the law courts, the existence of such a place, shows that life does have meaning and purpose. It doesn't just consist of a series of random events with no logical connection. No, justice is meted out. Those who do what is right are rewarded for their good behaviour. Those who act wickedly are punished for their misdeeds. If he's looking for evidence that life has order and purpose, this is where he will find it, surely. But if that's what the writer is expecting to find, then he's in for a terrible disappointment. Verse 16, we read, "Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness." So he's sitting there, observing the proceedings in the court, and a deep sense of unease comes over him. Here cases are being tried by those who are entrusted with dispensing justice. And surely people who have such an onerous responsibility will be beyond reproach, won't they? Those tasked with deciding the guilt or the innocence of others must themselves be upright and moral people. But as he looks at these people, he realizes that they are anything but. they are as bad, if not worse, than the people that they are supposed to be judging. Here, in the place where justice is supposed to be meted out, the place where righteousness should be the standard, wickedness is the order of the day. Those who are in positions of authority, those whom we would expect to make wise and good decisions, are actually evil themselves and hand out perverse judgments in place of justice. Of course, the writer isn't saying that all courts are corrupt and that there is no such thing as justice at the human level. But he is saying that these things are far from rare. We don't have to look very far back in history to find many examples. Neither do we have to look very far in our present day to see that the writer's observations are bang up to date. Think for a moment about life in Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s. There were established there the Sondergerichte, or the special courts, and they were set up with the specific purpose of eliminating all opposition to the Nazi regime. The normal justice system was gradually replaced with these political courts with their extensive powers. And those who in any way opposed the madness of Hitler's rule were imprisoned and often executed with little or no opportunity to defend themselves. While at the same time, those who committed unspeakable crimes against life and liberty of others were allowed to go unchecked. So you may say, well, that's an extreme example from history. But even if we come to the present day, it's not hard to find similar situations. In this month's Barnabas prayer diary, we read of the Iranian pastor Victor Bet Tamraz, who along with his wife and son has been imprisoned for supposedly acting against national security, when in reality their only crime was to hold Christian meetings in the Farsi language in their own home. So in his attempt to make sense of life in this world, this writer of Ecclesiastes has to confront this perplexing observation. In the place where you would hope to find justice, all too often it's the opposite that's found. Those who are entrusted with the solemn task of judging others are often more interested in preserving political power than in administering justice. And in the face of this distressing reality, he considers two possible conclusions, the first of which brings us to our second heading, which is a comforting possibility. A comforting possibility, and this is verse 17. So as the writer observes the corrupt courts dispensing deeply flawed justice, the thought comes into his mind that seems to bring him a degree of comfort, that there is a higher authority than these evil judges. Verse 17, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. Wicked people may escape justice in this life, but won't continue to do so forever. The time will come when they have to stand trial in a higher court. They will have to give account of themselves before God, the judge of all people. Even those earthly judges who have appeared to answer to no one, they will have to answer to him. And unlike human judges, God will always give a verdict that is right and true. He won't be swayed by financial bribes or by political pressure. He won't even be hoodwinked by clever lawyers, because he sees and knows all things, including the thoughts and the motives of people's hearts. So those who have lived wickedly in this present world will finally receive the penalty that they deserve. And those who have been unjustly treated by earthly courts and rulers will be vindicated. Evil verdicts that have gone against them will be overturned by heaven's perfect justice. The writer takes comfort from this prospect of final justice, because it shows that life is not ultimately without meaning. It reflects the fact that there is a God-given order to all things. There is a time for every matter and for every work, as he says. His words here echo that well-known passage that we read earlier on beginning at verse 1 of chapter 3. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, and so on. Life is not a series of random, unconnected events. There is order and purpose in life, because God is in control of all things, and he is a God of order and purpose. If there is a time for everything, that must include justice. We might not see it in this life. It might not be dispensed in human courts. However, this life is not all that there is. Beyond death, all human beings will have to stand before the ultimate judge and receive perfect justice. But even as he begins to take comfort from this prospect, the writer is suddenly struck by another thought. Remember, he began this section using that phrase, under the sun. And he's trying to look at life from a purely earthbound perspective, without God in the picture. And as he's pondered this perplexing reality of corrupt human justice, he's been unable to remove God from the picture altogether. And he's comforted himself to some extent with this thought that God, as the judge of all, will be the one who will have the final say, the one who will right all wrongs. But then as we move to verse 18, it's as though he suddenly comes to himself. And he has to drag himself back from such an idea. He has to remember that he's supposed to be looking at things from a purely human standpoint. The idea comes to him that perhaps, there is no ultimate justice after all. And that brings us to our third heading. A bleak alternative. This is verses 18 to 22. So as our writer surveys the widespread injustice in the world, the thought comes to him that perhaps this is God's way of showing human beings that they don't, after all, have a special place in the creation, that they are in fact no different from the animals. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. The thought comes to our writer that in the final analysis, there appears to be very little difference between man and the beasts. Both are made from the dust of the earth. Their bodies consist of the same atoms as the rest of creation. Both have life. They are born, they breathe, they eat and drink, they move around on the earth, they mate and produce offspring. But then both grow old, their bodies decline, and they die. And those atoms that came from the ground in the first place return there. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. That is the second conclusion that enters the writer's mind as he contemplates this perplexing issue of human injustice. Perhaps it's not really surprising that human attempts at justice are so flawed, that they are marked by corruption and wickedness. After all, if people are no different from the animals, what else would you expect? The world of animals is marked by great cruelty and suffering. You only have to watch one of David Attenborough's documentaries to see it. The strong and the powerful prey on the weak and vulnerable. Parents expend much time and energy in raising their young, only to see them wiped out in an instant by some predator. But one thing you'll never observe in the animal world is any sense of moral outrage. No protest groups are organised. There are no law courts. Cruelty and death are part of the scenery, and no one bats an eyelid. They just get on with the business of everyday life until it's their turn to die. So our writer's asking himself, why get so hung up about injustice in society? Perhaps the real explanation is that human beings have been getting ideas above their station. by establishing these law courts, by attempting to ensure fair play, aren't they living in denial, failing to spot what is so obvious, that really they are no different from the animals? Ultimately, the same thing will happen to them as happens to the beasts. They will die and their bodies will disintegrate. There will be no final reckoning. Some people like to think that there is a difference, that man has a spirit that returns to God at death, while the spirits of animals is buried with them. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth, he says in verse 21. That seems like a nice idea, says the writer, but what evidence is there really for it? It might be true, but then again, it might not. So from this earthbound perspective, the writer is now ready to draw his conclusion. He's troubled himself with this matter of injustice in human society. Why is it that in the very place where one would expect to find justice, the opposite is true, and so often wickedness prevails? He's briefly considered the possibility that there is a higher court, that people will one day have to give an account of themselves before God. But then he's come down in favour of a much more bleak alternative, that in fact, it doesn't really matter. Justice or injustice, it's all the same really. Human beings are just the same as the animals. Both came from the dust, and both will return to the dust. Both are on the earth for a brief period, but then they will leave it and be forgotten. And in the light of that fact, is it really worth getting so concerned about matters of justice? Is it really such a problem that the courts hand out perverse verdicts and that those who commit great crimes go unpunished? If human beings are really no different from the animals, then life has no ultimate purpose. And we shouldn't be surprised if it's full of contradictions. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity, verse 19. And if that's true, says the writer, then the only sensible course of action is to try and make the best of whatever life sends your way. Verse 21, so I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be done after him? That's the best advice that he can give from his earthbound perspective. Just get on with whatever you find to do in life and try and enjoy it as best you can. Don't worry yourself about the big questions of justice and righteousness. Don't waste your time agonising about the fact that some people are literally getting away with murder. What's the point in getting hung up on all these things? You're only here for a few years. You've no idea what lies beyond the grave, if anything. So why concern yourself with such things? Well, the writer's conclusion, I suggest, corresponds quite well to the view of life that many people take today. They're content to view themselves as essentially no different from the animals, just perhaps that they're a bit further along the evolutionary pathway. They're content with a purely earthbound perspective, to leave God out of the picture. And so they focus their energies on making the best of whatever life sends their way. They don't trouble themselves with thoughts of whatever may lie beyond it. Perhaps this morning that describes your approach to life. And perhaps you find that earthbound perspective quite appealing. But I want you to consider, is it quite such an attractive view as it seems at first glance? What about when you sit down to watch the TV news in the evening? You see items about the authorities in Myanmar abusing their power and causing untold suffering to their own citizens. Or you pick up the local newspaper and you read about an elderly person being brutally attacked in their own home and the perpetrators getting off with a light sentence. Or you read an internet article about the Holocaust and you wonder how many of those who carried out such barbaric cruelty were ever brought to any kind of justice. When you think about such things, is there something within you that cries out for justice? Do you have a sense that there should be some kind of final accounting? However much you try and convince yourself that there is no higher authority, can you truly live consistently with that view? Well, the writer of our passage couldn't. Even when he deliberately set out to leave God out of the picture, he wasn't able to, as we saw in verse 17. He couldn't escape at least the possibility that there is a God of justice, that he has appointed a time for judgment, and that every human being will one day stand before him and give an account. I wonder what you made of our second heading, that the judgment of God is a comforting prospect. Well, at one level, surely that has to be true, doesn't it? Surely there can be no more alarming thought than that there will be no final accounting. All the injustice and wickedness that we see around us today counts for nothing, and that it will ultimately go unpunished. Or that if there is a God, he is indifferent to all of it. What about if we bring matters closer to home? It's all very well to think about God bringing corrupt judges and brutal dictators to justice. But if he is truly a just God, then he must judge all people on the same basis. As you think about your life, how confident can you be that it will stand up to his scrutiny? You certainly haven't committed the kinds of gross injustice and cruelty that we thought about in some of our examples today. But can you say that you've always treated others with kindness and fairness? Can you say that you've never taken advantage of someone else's weakness? Can you say that you've never spoken harsh, wounding words to others? Viewed in those terms, perhaps the future judgment of God is far from a comforting thought for you. Well, the reality is that all human beings will stand before God one day and account to him for how we have lived in this world. And none of us can face that prospect with any degree of comfort if we're relying on our own ability to live up to his standards. All of us have broken his law. All of us have fallen far, far short of the perfect obedience that he requires. If we are left to ourselves, then we will face that terrible prospect of his perfect justice being meted out to us. We will face that sentence of everlasting punishment that the Bible calls hell. Well, that's the bad news, but there is also good news, very good news. There is one man who has already faced that judgment of God, one who has already taken the punishment, not for anything that he had done, but for the sins and the crimes of others. Jesus Christ, in his death on the cross, took the full punishment of God for the sins of his people, for all those who put their trust in him. And today, he offers you the opportunity to become one of those people. In fact, he calls you to do so. He calls you to abandon all of your attempts to put yourself right with God and to trust only in him. He calls you to believe that he died in your place and satisfied the justice of God on your behalf. And if you will come to him and trust him, then that terrible record of your sin will be blotted out, and you will be able to face that prospect of God's judgment with calmness and with confidence rather than in fear. But perhaps this morning you are a Christian. You're already believing in Jesus Christ. But you are deeply troubled as you live in this world. Those who break God's laws, those who trample on other people, seem to continue to get away with it and even to prosper. Maybe you're especially concerned about your fellow Christians who suffer injustice in different parts of the world. Other human beings, whether it's the law courts or the leaders of the nations, seem powerless to bring their persecutors to account. That's something that's troubled many of God's people down the centuries. You only have to read the Psalms to find that. Well, you can take comfort, true comfort this morning, from the reality of God's coming judgment. He sees all things. He has perfect understanding of every situation. He knows all that his people endure. And as the judge of all the earth, he will do what is right. Amen.